I hope you're strapped in and strapped on. Neurodiversity and sexuality to a little bit of kink and BDSM and non-monogamy. Neurospiciness in relationship to physical spiciness.
There's ways to check in that are sexy still and also accessible and accommodating.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am joined by another very special guest. I'm so excited. So Lilith Fox is a BIPOC, queer, kinky, and polyamorous board-certified sexologist, Kinsey Institute student researcher, professional speaker, and educator. Her work focuses on the intersectionality of marginalized identities, alternative sexuality, and social justice. Informed by her personal and professional experiences, she provides BDSM and non-monogamy cultural competency consulting for clinical, academic, and research settings, and facilitates workshops on sexuality, justice, and inclusion. Her expertise has been, no big deal, featured in several major publications, including Cosmopolitan, Glamour, Kinkly, and Men's Health. Lilith Fox, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Before we get into today's topic, which will cover kind of everything from neurodiversity and sexuality to a little bit of kink and BDSM and non-monogamy, I'd love to have you introduce yourself in kind of in a human way, right? So I'm going to pass it over to you. I think you have an anecdote for us today, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you kind of hit all the highlights there, but oh gosh, what's interesting about me? Plant mom. I have over 100 houseplants. That's out of control. definitely do the whole corporate day job thing, but transitioning more into sexology, which has been an incredible journey. Identify as kinky queer. Chaos queer is really the moniker that's fitting now. Yeah, I guess that and pretty much any direction my ADHD takes me is probably the best way to describe me.
Amazing. And I mean, we'll get to that more in depth soon too, right? So my listeners know I like to open up a space for guests to share a sex or dating anecdote, something that tells them a little bit about you as a person. So do you have an anecdote for us today?
Oh, do I ever? And buckle ups.
Be buckled up.
Fair warning, it's a little icky, but as you said, bodies are bodies, so we're here for it. Despite being a sexologist and understanding how anatomy works and all of that, I can't say I have this fear anymore, but I definitely did.
Yeah,
I just had this irrational fear of something getting lost up in my vagina, and And it's mostly because I have a few friends that are ER doctors, and I'm like, you know, if I end up there, I'm going to ruin the sanctity of gaming nights. It's just going to be real weird if somebody's going to have to be like Chris Steep and me, and then we go play D&D the next weekend. So
yeah.
I really wanted to just kind of preserve that. So, you know, all this is going on in the back of my mind. And a former partner of mine had a genital piercing. And so, of course, I was like, it's going to get lost. I am paranoid about this. So then I thought, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to be brave. Everything's going to be fine. Uh-huh. And in the middle of all of the hot, steamy action, I look down and it looks like, and I'm on top at this point,
yeah,
it looks like we're recreating the scene from Carrie. And of course I lose it. I just come completely unglued and I'm like, oh my God, it's lost, or it's torn out. Holy yeah. shit. I'm going to have to go to the ER. What if I've hurt them? And like this whole yeah. like meltdown is happening. And then, and then once we get into the shower and clean up, it's like, no, it's still there. What the fuck was happening? I'd actually started my period. And then, of course, I went into that whole shame spiral and then they yeah. had to console me. So, I mean, it ended up being a really funny moment. And it's like, yeah. oh, yeah, bodies are bodies and kind of icky, but funny. But yeah, it was a whole thing. And I think that's probably the anecdote that I would share.
No, I love that. I feel like that's such a relatable one, because there are so many things like that. I mean, for me, and I've talked about this a little while on the show, but I had an IUD for a while and I went back to the pill. And part of why psychologically I went back to the pill is I had so much anxiety about this contraption being inside me. And I was like, I don't know how, but like, it's going to hurt my partner, or it's going to get shoved into some weird crevice of my body where it's like, one, not working, and two, injuring me. Like, I think when you think about foreign bodies, it's stressful.
1,000%.
And you'd been paranoid. So I feel like if I'd been in the same headspace and looked down, I'd been like, oh shit, like exactly what I thought was going to happened.
Yes, all my worst fears confirmed.
Yes. No shame though. In my pilot episode anecdote, and for people who haven't listened to my pilot, go back and listen to it. It's, you know, aging drastically. But I like had a situation where I basically got a vaginal friction burn during sex. And it was a mess, right? Not quite carry level, but it was like rough. And then I had a panic attack like mid-coitus, right? So we've all been there.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you're okay. That I didn't even know a friction burn. I mean, well, yeah, I guess it could happen.
I had just gotten out of a long-term monogamous relationship. It was the first time I was having casual sex in a long time. And I was like, just so uptight, because I was like, I need to be the hottest thing that's ever happened. And I was so focused on being like, you know, a performance queen and not like actually enjoying myself, that it's just the driest place it's ever been. It was my body. It was just no moisture.
My God. So anyway, that's challenging. Thank you for sharing that. That's challenging.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for sharing your story. That's, I mean, like you said, there's a lot to unpack when something like that happens, but it's all good. And if you can laugh in hindsight, I think that's important.
For sure. It's all part of the lore.
Yeah, for sure. Also, I'm a big tabletop role player, so I like where you threw in the D&D reference. We learned that offline. So let's get in a little bit to your background in working kind of in the sexology and related fields. How did you get into the work that you do?
Yeah, so it was kind of a wild transition. I actually worked in corporate and tech marketing for a decade. Before that, I wanted to be a lawyer. That was a whole thing. Ended up going into marketing, and I genuinely loved it. It wasn't like I hated it and then found my calling. That was always just what I did and kind of part of my personality. But then on the other side of that, I've been involved in the kink and polyamorous communities for actually about as long. And it always felt like there was this duality to my life, but kink was such, I mean, that was my family of choice. That is so much of my vulnerable identity. And as I started to transition more into like an educator in that space, I thought, okay, well, I really want to learn how to do this correctly. Mm-hmm. So I ended up discovering this organization called ASECT, which is the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. I didn't know this was a thing. And so I thought, okay, I could just get my sexuality educator certification. And then I was like, wow, this is actually quite the process. But you know what? I don't even have to do it. I can just take one class on how to make a lesson plan, and we'll call it a day. So I ended up finding, and they were an ASEC CE provider, the Sex Ed Lecture Series. Mm-hmm. They had a class with Dr. Tanya Bass and Bill Taverner, and it was called Let's Make a Lesson Plan. And it was in August of 2 years ago. And I remember just being in that space, and it's a virtual class, but just being so overcome with the authenticity that I saw, because I always had to have this division in my personal and professional life. And I thought, oh my gosh, I can actually do this like for real as a real job. But I didn't really want to give up on marketing either. And so finding kind of where I fit in there, I decided, well, let me just work on the certification in the background. And, continue to take courses and realize there's such a need for cultural competency of working with alternative sexuality communities in particular.
Yeah.
That I just kind of, and I feel like I'm still figuring it out in a lot of ways, but I just kind of started to fall into place with it. I realized a lot of people in my industry, sexology, don't really have any marketing skills, and you have to market yourself in a certain way because of censorship. And so I kind of just started to do my own thing there, and you know, I'm just kind of going with it, whatever flows in that direction. And it's been a good feel. And I'm still marketing, so I'm still, you know, getting that cup filled, but I'm also giving back to my community and to really just the sexuality community and everything as a whole. So it feels pretty good.
Yeah, that's awesome. Just looking, obviously, at your bio that everyone heard, but looking at your website and seeing that you've carved out, I think, a really interesting niche for yourself, right, of this combination of marketing expertise, DEI and B, being like kink, queer, BIPOC, polyamorous, I mean, friendly to so many important communities that, to your point, don't necessarily have a space in a lot of various sectors of the world. So it's super interesting. And I think it seems like you're contributing a lot to, like you said, filling your own cup, but through helping the communities that you care about, which is amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm loving it.
I love it. So one of the topics that we're getting into today is sort of the relationship or intersectionality between neurodiversity and sexuality. And I think it's a really important topic because, one, neurodiversity, I feel like, isn't something we were talking about in sort of a public forum until recently, like many other topics. And I think people didn't have an understanding of what neurodiversity means, or, you know, that it's not, doesn't need to be this like weird, taboo, shameful thing, like the way that we treat so many words and communities, right?
Definitely.
For folks who maybe aren't too familiar with the term neurodiversity, could you just define what it means and maybe provide one or two examples for context?
Absolutely. So neurodiversity literally translates to how your brain deviates from what is considered, quote unquote, the norm. Now, mind you, this is not a medical definition. It's actually more of a social one because the norm is very subjective. It's very subjective to the culture you're in. It's very subjective to the environment you're in. What is functional in one environment is considered dysfunctional in another. And there's also not necessarily this binary of neurodivergent and neurotypical, which is somebody who's, I call it a brain flavor, aligns more with the norm. Yeah. So if your brain just works in a way that's different, that's technically neurodivergent. The other thing is it is a huge umbrella. So under that umbrella falls ADHD, autism, trauma, actually, bipolar, really, it's so much falls under that.
Yeah. Thank you. And you know, it's interesting. I have a few friends actually who are OCD, and one of them was at a work event. Funny enough, she works in marketing, and someone was talking about sort of like their DE&I initiatives in the workplace. Not sure they include the B. I feel like B is catching on, but it's not mainstream yet. You know what I mean? But someone was saying how important it is to have neurodiverse representation on the team in addition to some of the other sort of DE&I initiatives, and listed OCD as being neurodiverse. And my friend panicked a little bit because she was like, I've already been grappling with the fact that I was diagnosed with OCD and everything that implies, and like having to process that. And now I'm getting thrown this other label. And I was like, that's totally valid reaction, but let's process why you're having that reaction. And also like neurodiverse doesn't, I mean, you don't have to identify as neurodiverse going forward if that doesn't resonate with you. And we kind of talked through it. And I said, also, you know, talk to your therapist about this reaction because it's valid, but you should unpack it. But that's the thing, is it does encompass so much more than I think people understand, which to me, I think is more liberating than trying to pigeonhole people into, to your point, neurodivergent or neurotypical.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for sharing that. I think it's that fear of yet another label and how am I going to fit this into, you know, the lexicon of my lore is terrifying. So I totally get that. And I think that's kind of a similar reaction that I had in a lot of ways. I mean, I was late diagnosed ADHD. Of course, I was diagnosed with depression, anxiety, all of that. I think, at about my early 20s. ADHD was about, I think 28 is when she rolled in, and, you know, everything else just kind of peppered in through. And it's like, well, shit, now what do I do with this new piece of information? Does it help me? Does it hinder me? And then grappling with other people's reactions is definitely challenging.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes sense. And, you know, for folks who are, well, a lot of people, at least that I speak to, who are kind of in the millennial generation, typically people assigned female at birth don't get diagnosed until they're in their late 20s, early 30s, right? Because
yeah.
the symptoms that have been chronicled as being typical of ADHD are so different in penis owners, right, versus vulva owners. And like,
definitely.
I think the expansion of our understanding of what neurodivergence looks like hopefully helps people get the appropriate diagnosis and the appropriate support or treatment if needed. But it can be a lot to process, especially when there are multiple folks in the chat, if you will.
Yes. Oh, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah. And, you know, I'm so glad also that you brought it up in the context of DEIB, because neurodiversity absolutely affects how your workplace belongingness exists, how you can yeah. exist in a space authentically as you, because you do have to mask all day. And it is an exhausting additional thing that you have to face to just function in a world that was literally built against you. And then to the other side of that, if you have intersectional identities of being a BIPOC person, being a queer person, gender expansive identities, all of that, it really adds so much more nuance in how your neurodivergent symptoms can actually come out to play. So there's so much to it. And it just, I think, really hits at a lot of different vulnerability levels.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a few responses to that. I mean, I totally agree. I think you also pointed out something important that I just wanted to double click on for folks, is that you mentioned trauma, right? Can yeah. chemically impact the way that your brain functions, and that can be a form of neurodiversity too. So I wanted to point that out because I think people underestimate the impact that trauma can have on the way that your brain functions, right? But exactly, like, you mentioned masking. So for folks who aren't familiar with that term, and feel free to add, you know, detail to kind of how I'm describing it. But my understanding is literally the way that neurodiverse folks, you know, kind of seek to fit the mold of that subjective, quote unquote, norm, right? So given any context or situation, masking in order to fit in however they perceive that in that context. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because at the end of the day, we still have bills to pay. We still have, you know, jobs and everything else. So if the world was built for neurotypical brains, our neurospicy ones make it more challenging. And so it's just fulfilling all the things, despite how hard it is.
Yeah.
The social obligations. The yeah.
Totally. Neurospicy. I like that term
yeah,
too.
That's, I forget where I heard that. And it's been fun to use that instead. Neurospicy, brain flavors.
Yeah.
That said, I do know of people who don't particularly like the term. They feel like it trivializes them. I think both perspectives are totally valid.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't feel authentic for you, don't use it.
Yeah. I think that's the beauty of language, right? Like, I can understand why someone might feel that way, but I'm the type of person who likes to make light of almost anything, which is, you know, yeah, something I've processed therapy. But the funnier the language I can use to describe myself, I will.
Same.
And often to the discomfort of people around me. So I sometimes have to be a little bit mindful.
Honestly, story of my life. Yeah. Rein it in. Your trauma made you funny, but not yeah. everybody feels that way.
100%. Yeah. If I could make, yeah, no, I don't have to go into it, but there's plenty. I do it. We all, yeah, I get it. So the other thing you kind of touched on, I wanted to dive kind of further into and think about it, this lens of neurodiversity or neurospiciness in relationship to sexuality or physical spiciness.
Intimacy.
Yeah. So what are some common misconceptions or stereotypes that maybe you've sought to dispel or have identified that should be dispelled kind of when we think about the relationship between neurodiversity and sexual exploration or kind of just being a sexual being?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good question. And it's such a big question too, because yeah. there's so many different answers.
Yeah.
And I can definitely only really speak to my lived experience in terms of the intimacy. Obviously, I can come at it from an academic perspective as well. Yeah. But like, a a lot of the misconceptions with ADHD in particular is that, and really, interestingly enough, polyamory kind of makes a foray into this as well. They say, well, you're polyamorous because you're ADHD, you get bored quickly. Or there's a level of promiscuity associated with ADHD because you're just looking for that next dopamine hit. And be that as it may, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm doing that with partners and that I necessarily consider these intimate dynamics as just the next dopamine hit.
Yeah.
And there is also just a level of, I would say, discrediting somebody's real intimate and lack of a better word, commitment, I guess, like building that foundation of a relationship. It's a little bit discredited with ADHD. At least that's been my experience. And that's so unfortunately just attributed, and it's so not true. And then on the other side of that, people who identify as being, or people who have autism, or are a person with autism, however they choose to define that, are often associated with being not into any kind of physical intimacy, having more of that, I guess, social wall. And I am on the spectrum as well, but which is the thing, it's a spectrum. So even within that, there's so much nuance in how that pans out. But that doesn't mean that people with autism do not want sexual intimacy, or that they can't be social and have these intimate moments with partners and with the people around them. So those are definitely some misconceptions that I try to address. And to the same thing with trauma is that, well, this person is going to either be kinky, which not always true, or they are going to, well, they're either going to be kinky or they're going to be very much not kinky because of trauma associations there. So I think really just depending on your brain flavor, there's a whole slew of misconceptions that we all have to unfortunately work against.
Yeah, those are some really good examples. And I think to me, the common thread, unfortunately, is sort of this element of dehumanization. And I hate, maybe, I mean, I worry about using words that have sort of that severe language, but I do think that no matter what the misconception is, it's either, okay, well, you are, you know, quote unquote promiscuous or inconsistent, or, you know, your non-monogamy is sort of invalidated or trivialized, or you are completely desexualized, right? And it's sort of like, you can't win. It's like opposite ends of the spectrum. And either way, it's taking something about a person that, that may be something that they, that feels like a defining factor in their lives. And maybe it is, but it isn't the only part about them as a person, and making it the entirety of who they are, which to me feels like a version of dehumanization. And I think it's unfair and really crummy.
No, I completely agree with you. I think actually that that is the perfect word to describe it, because yes, I'm neurospicy. I have all these things that that shape my worldview and can affect the way I give and receive stimuli around me. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the only thing about me. I also have a fuck ton of plants. So that's another thing about me that isn't a trait.
Second personality trait, plant mom.
Yes. Bring it.
I love it. So I do have kind of a follow-up question. And again, I think it's kind of two questions in one. So sorry for asking all the big questions, capital B.
Yeah, I love it.
So how can the presence of neurodiversity in whatever form, you know, kind of in one or more partners impact conversations or even negotiations around things like kink and BDSM or, you know, ethical non-monogamy?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good question. I love it, because
there's a lot to unpack.
there so is. I think from the perspective of the neurodivergent person, and again, this is my experience, we almost feel the need to make up for, to continue masking, to apologize that we have different communication needs and different intimacy needs. And so I found myself really early on trying to make the other person comfortable with my needs, which is not fair. It's, you know, again, it's dehumanizing, like you said. And it was things like, well, hey, I, you know, certain kinds of sensations I just don't like. It's just because my brain works this way. And then, you know, I would just go on and on and on. And, you know, there's nothing sexy about that, right? So there was always that element to it. But then anytime I was going to like negotiate like kink or BDSM kind of scenes, if the other person was neurotypical and, you know, you unfortunately do run into people that are going to stereotype you, they would say, well, be sure you write this down or you're going to forget. Or, you know, they didn't think that I had the capacity to actually give and receive consent in an intimate or kink setting because I would forget the safe word or forget what the limits were. So lots of challenges there, or again, with non-monogamy, that I would forget that I had a partner. Like, absolutely ridiculous, right? What? And yeah, it's kind of, again, those misconceptions coming forward. And it's unfortunately also the neurospicy person almost feeling the need to apologize on behalf of these misconceptions.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like in those specific situations, just like the complete removal of your agency, right? Like saying, no, you can't consent, or you'll forget that. I mean, forgetting you have a partner, mind blowing. Like I'm clearly speechless in response to that, because I can't imagine anyone ever for a minute buying that, but obviously they do, because why would they have said it otherwise? But just completely baffling.
Yeah,
people jump to conclusions because of a label, really, because of the way that we use language. That's why they have that stereotype. I mean, that's crazy.
Forgetting a whole ass partner. I'm like, yeah, no, it's because of my ADHD. I feel like I'm the most meticulous type A person. I have spreadsheets for things. I mean, everything. Like, if anything, yeah, I'm overcompensating for communicating and keeping all that going. I even have a spreadsheet for my kinks. Like, I love all that. About that. I would love to share it. It is, I'm very proud of it. It's a negotiation spreadsheet. And I think it's actually just a really trauma-informed, neurospicy-friendly way of communicating consent. So happy to share that.
Love that. Yeah, I love a template. I like everything in writing, and I like, I'm an over-communicator. If things aren't in writing, I struggle. And so sometimes having things like kink and BDSM in writing, I'm like, okay, my brain can map this. I got it. I love it.
Yeah. And it's such a powerful self-growth tool as well. Like, I have every version of my spreadsheet saved, and I can just go back and like journal and like explore maybe why something was a limit and why it's not anymore. So lots of really great things to do with written negotiations.
Yeah. And obviously completely dispelling so many stereotypes around, you know, your brain flavor.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
In situations, either kind of from your own personal lived experience or any other information you have on hand mentally, but like in situations where you have the anticipation of participating in, you know, maybe a relationship or just like a one-off BDSM scene or whatever that looks like for you, and someone uses that kind of language with you about your neurodiversity, I mean, how do you respond? If you are comfortable, how would you suggest other people respond if they're in situations like that?
Yeah. I mean, really don't do the emotional labor that you don't consent to giving. You don't ever owe anybody anything. Being an educator, I tend to go into that teacher mode, and I'm like, well, you know, let me assume positive intent. Let me just educate them. A lot of times people just don't have the updated language. You know, we still have people that say Asperger's when they're trying to describe somebody who is on the spectrum. And it's not, at least in my experience for the most part, it doesn't come from a place of negativity. And then as soon as you tell them, well, actually it's a spectrum, and, you know, this is the wording to use, I've never had really an issue there. And obviously there are those outlier examples of somebody who will just say something heinous. And it's like, well, you know, the great thing is people tend to tell on themselves. So maybe this was a good indication that you shouldn't play with this person or have an intimate dynamic with them. So I would say, just for the most part, don't ever feel obligated, but if it makes you feel better or there is the possibility that they just don't have the language, talk to them about it. And also in the context of like sexuality, frame your neurospicy needs as just needs, because that's what they are. Very similar to just asking for your intimacy needs to be met and like what you do and don't like in the bedroom. Yeah, you also can just frame it as that. So it doesn't have to be this like external thing that you have to always accommodate for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it really goes back to this idea that it's not, again, not to say that any neurospicy label isn't worth having, but so much, in my opinion, so much of what gets muddied along the way is the way that we use language, or the way that people make use of jargon without really understanding what it means, or making assumptions without kind of doing follow-up research. And to your point, like, everyone likes what they like, and everyone doesn't like what they don't like. And in any kink or BDSM situation, there are sometimes times where you don't know what you don't like until it happens. And that's why you have things like safe words. And that's why you have things like ongoing wholehearted verbal consent. And, you know, that doesn't change if you are neurospicy, right? Like, that's regardless of what your identity is, what your background is, what your gender is, you know, that's just humans having sex, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I really love that we are focusing on language, because I think that while labels can be liberating, they can also be restricting. Mm-hmm. I try to consider them like a guidepost. It's a great direction to go, but you still have to go on the journey. You're still going to come across all sorts of different things. But also, two people with the same diagnoses are not going to have the same symptoms, the same lived experience. It's, you know, a BIPOC femme, AFAB woman is not going to have, with ADHD, is not going to manifest the same way as like a cishet white man with ADHD.
Yeah,
So much nuance to that, same diagnosis. And so it can be challenging sometimes to be like, well, I'm not, you know, fill in the blank enough because I'm not doing this set of things. So yeah, no, I love that just kind of asking for the needs to be met instead of here's the label and let's go with whatever assumptions fall under that, I think is a more holistic and humanizing way of having conversations of intimacy and desire and needs.
Yeah. I'm curious if sort of tied to that, your kink spreadsheets, are they sort of just you mapping out like what you like and dislike, or is there more nuance to it that you feel like is important to, you know, your safety, whether it tied to neurospiciness or not?
Yeah. Oh gosh. So my spreadsheets initially started off because I am a recovering people pleaser, and a little bit I'd sometimes forget my needs and my limits. I would be in a moment and I would be like, I just want everything, and this person's really pretty, and so I don't have limits, never heard of her, and you know, I just I would just kind of be in the moment and be on all the endorphins and want everything, and I would potentially put myself and my other partners at a greater risk because I wasn't able to authentically and safely communicate. And so the spreadsheets initially started off as let me just make a bulleted list of the things I don't like, the not tonight list. And then it started to grow from there, because then I realized, well, you know, this particular play thing or this particular type of play can be defined in so many ways and expressed in so many ways.
Yeah.
And you know, anytime I wanted to have a certain kind of play, I couldn't just say yes in the moment. I'm like, sorry, there's paperwork. I got to get to the spreadsheets.
Yeah.
But then I realized it became such a powerful self-reflection and journaling tool. And I wanted to have just a resource where I could refer to it and be like, you know, this is where I was, this is where I can be. And not that you have to necessarily level up in your explorations of kink, but I started to include things like, so I have just a list of different kinds of play. I have it divided on like, here's sexual, here's this like medical play, here's rope, here's all these different pages to the spreadsheets. And have I experienced this? Yes or no? Is this something I want with like an intimate partner or a casual partner? Yes or no? If I was going to do a scene, what would the duration be? So like, you know, less than an hour all the way up to however long. The intensity, all these different categories. I have a comment section. And very recently, I added a section of how do you define this particular thing? What does that look like for you? And it can seem a bit daunting to have this, like, you know, book given to you of spreadsheets, but really it's just a conversation starter. Yeah. It's a, let me break this down in my own brain and kind of start building how this scene and intimate experience is going to look for me. So it's first having these conversations with yourself and yeah. then taking that to partners and people that you want to share it with and just kind of having a place to refer back to.
I think that's really fucking cool. Like, I think so. I mean, so much of what folks in the sex ed, sex therapy, sex coach space talk about is like not necessarily this. I mean, I think sometimes problematic phrasing of like you have to love yourself first before you can love other people, because I think that that can be like a limiting phrase for a lot of people who struggle with kind of a variety of internal difficulties. But I do think it's important to know yourself before you play with other people. And that's not to say you can't know yourself while playing with other people and learn yourself by playing with other people, but you have to be open to learning, right? And I think having like an introspective guidebook is really helpful. And I think too, there's something about journaling after an encounter that's sort of like a form of self aftercare that like people, I don't know. We talk about aftercare obviously in the kink and BDSM space, but I don't know if I've ever thought about like, what am I doing for just me in aftercare? Like, what does that look like for me? Like when I reflect, what form does that need to take in order for me to feel fulfilled within my own sexuality, let alone the sex I'm having with other people. That's cool. I mean, again, I like a spreadsheet though. So
yeah, definitely. And, you know, I think a lot of the time, two parts to this, aftercare is often seen as, all right, we're going to cuddle for half an hour, then we're cool. But the reality is, I think for a lot of people, I mean, barring any sort of like physicality need, like obviously if you do medical placing, you may need first aid, whatever it is, barring any of that, so much of this experience can kind of come to you days, weeks, months, years after the fact. Really? And having that opportunity to explore that is really powerful, and it can be such an intimate part of the experience. But then on the other side of that, with knowing yourself, I love that you bring that up, because I do agree that whole love yourself first, what the fuck does that mean, right?
Yeah.
But I think just from a baseline experience of, you can only give and receive consent if it's informed. I need to be fully informed of the risks that I take on, the risks that I may, you know, contribute to. And yeah. part of that is understanding, where do I fit in? What is my consent framework around this experience? And so I think for folks who may feel like, oh, I love yourself thing doesn't really apply, just think of it from a consent perspective. Yes. And I think that just kind of informs it a little more, at least for my brain flavor, a little more tangibly.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. And I like the notion of like love yourself. I just find that it can be so limiting, because, you know, we live in a society where so many people feel so much shame about so many things. And I don't think that, you know, being in the process of processing that shame or unpacking it or whatever that looks like shouldn't inhibit you from relationships, right? Or whatever context people are kind of using that phrase for. So I feel like, to your point, having like a tangible, you know, I hate to say task, but something tangible, something that, you know, keeps everyone informed, like you said, and enthusiastic, right? Like it's sort of, I'm trying not to use corporate language. You probably feel me. I keep wanting to call it an action item.
And I was going to say measurable success.
Yeah. My sex KPIs. Like it is.
Oh, I need to completely reframe it. Sex KPIs. I actually really fucking love that. That's hilarious.
I'm literally now picturing my corporate job KPI monitor, and I'm wondering what I can do to change it to make it about sex. Anyway,
like, how do I make an analytics dashboard of my sex life?
Wow.
I'm here for that.
I love it.
That's amazing.
My partner is somewhere in our apartment being like, what am I hearing right now? Yes. What are you measuring? but yeah, like I do think that there is something to be said about absolute transparency with yourself, and absolute transparency with the other folks involved. I just feel like regardless of your brain flavor, those things have to be present for like, I don't know, true hope of 100% consent and 100% pleasure, hopefully, ideally.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Or as close as you can get to it. Right.
Yeah. So in your mind, how, I keep asking you the big question. So, you
know,
run
with it. Bring it. I love it.
In your mind, you know, how can society, good start, how can society be more inclusive and supportive of neurospicy, neurodiverse folks when it comes to their sexual identities, their alternative sexualities in some situations, and relationships?
I love that question. I feel like I've said that about every question, but you ask all the amazing questions.
I'm glad. Nice.
I think so much of what creates more inclusion is creating more visibility and for, you know, the quote unquote allyship to step forward. So even if you are not a neurospicy person or don't have any accessibility needs, I typically will start off like a scene or an intimate experience by speaking to my own accessibility needs.
Yeah.
I'll say, you know, my accessibility needs are met right now. Or, and that also provides some transparency, because if you go into really any intimate experience, certainly kink ones with like a bad headspace, whatever it may be, that can kind of manifest and get worse. Right. So you really should speak to that. And sometimes, you know, speaking to it from an accessibility standpoint is helpful. So mm-hmm. I'll say like, you know, I had a little bit of an emotional day today, but other than that, my accessibility needs are met. So from the get-go, I'm already kind of setting an open and communication where I'm showing this person that it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay mm-hmm. to have accessibility needs. It's okay if they're not met. And so starting there and just creating really accessibility to be more than just a, you know, quote unquote, just a disabled person's problem, right?
Yeah.
We shouldn't wait for shit to hit the fan before we try to fix it, right? So I think starting there, understanding that a lot of these needs, any kind of neurospicy need, any, you know, I guess proclivity maybe is the word or not the word to use, treat that as like a, just a different accessibility need, desire need, however you have to frame it, see the validity in that.
Mm.
And I think assume positive intent. Like if I show up a little bit late, I promise it's not because I don't value your time or I don't value you. It's because my brain genuinely can't, I'm so time blind. It's the whole thing. So assume positive intent, create visibility and address your own accessibility. And, you know, at the end of the day, we all will be disabled one day as we age with life experiences. And so I think treating it as some like far off problem that's never going to affect us is really what creates that division.
Hmm. I think there is something really powerful about this idea of creating space through example, through, you know, sharing in a moment of vulnerability so that there is, you know, an opportunity for others to share it as well. I think, especially when you're in a situation where, you know, folks are consenting to one level of physical intimacy or emotional intimacy, that, you know, creating the opportunity for additional layers of that to ensure that everyone is taken care of is something that I feel like we could apply to so many different situations that we just don't. It's one of the things I love about the BDSM community is there's such a need for this transparency and communication and negotiation that it opens the doors to creating, I think, safer spaces for people of all brain flavors or other flavors. And we don't apply those same principles in so many other life situations.
Absolutely. And I think just speaking to it, like if I speak to my accessibility needs, it kind of shows what answer I'm looking for as well. Because sometimes my neurospicy brain is like, if somebody asks me like a, you know, an open-ended question, like, does that feel good? Well, that can go a whole bunch of different directions. So say, for example, if I'm in a BDSM scene, I'm doing an impact scene, I'm bottoming. If somebody says, does that feel good? My brain will literally go, well, I want to say yes, but this is an impact scene. I'm supposed to be experiencing pain. So should that feel good? Is it supposed to feel bad? But what if I say it feels bad and they think I don't want to continue, but I do want to continue. And if they say I'm like enjoying myself, well, what if I'm not supposed to enjoy myself because this is kind of a sadistic fear placing. So my brain is doing all these somersaults and this person just wants to know if I'm enjoying myself. So providing, I guess, you know, a template of this is kind of the answer I'm looking for helps me not spiral too. So there's so much, I think, that can just be created just from living the example in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a great, great, like, little anecdote, because I think, one, obviously, a lot of different people focus to be present or mindful in sex, especially people who, I mean, maybe not especially, people who are part of marginalized or oppressed communities, right, who are like, okay, well, I'm supposed to be submissive in this situation, so I'm not going to be present because of, you know, whatever role they play. But I think in the context of you know, brain flavors and neurospiciness, understanding for people who don't have firsthand experience with it, understanding some of the practical application of all of this, right? It's like, you know, creating an opportunity to have a conversation of like, here's how I communicate and like what dirty talk should be, or what I'd like dirty talk to be for me for accessibility reasons. So that way I can get turned on by your words as opposed to get, you know, in a spiral, right?
Yeah, definitely. No, I you know, I hadn't even considered accessibility needs through dirty talk, but hell yes, definitely.
Yeah, I have been in situations personally where like certain, like if I'm prompted to dirty talk, like I'll panic, right? And so, and I'm an anxious girly. And so I've had to communicate in various situations. Like if you ask me an open-ended question, for example, I'm going to be like, right. But if it's something really specific, then I can, you know, I can respond and have fun with it. But it's sort of like, you know, what am I going to respond to without losing my mind in the middle of what is supposed to be like a hot and steamy time. Right. So, it all goes back to some self-awareness as well, which can be challenging for anyone, but I think you know, if you have the ability to figure out what works for you, in your case spreadsheets, right? Among other things, I'm sure, like then you can go from there in communicating with other people.
Definitely. And I think, you know, often people hear all this and they're like, oh, well, this isn't really sexy. It absolutely can be. I think even just playing with it, I mean, I call it like scene foreplay. You're having this negotiation communication, but you can still prompt these answers and even play around with it from the perspective of power and authority. So if, for example, I'm topping a scene and I really want to know if my bottom is enjoying themselves. And so actually a really good example, I was having a scene with this marvelously incredible human, and they were a little newer. And so we were actually doing a rope and an impact scene, and I was topping. And so given that they were newer, I was trying to be mindful of the fact that they may not fully be aware and knowledgeable of certain safety considerations to take into account. And so the furniture that they were on had these like ankle stocks, which made me a little nervous, because it was kind of a dark dungeon too. And so what I told them is, you know, I kind of knelt down. I said, all right, princess, what I need you to do is if your ankles start to tingle, you need to tell Mixtress that. And that was me informing her, this is a safety consideration to look for. This is kind of the answer that I'm looking for. Yeah. We're still in that headspace. We're starting that scene. And she then has this you know, information that like, shit, if my ankles start to tingle, then we need to come out of this. I also love establishing like a physical safe word. So mm-hmm. beforehand, I told them, I said, okay, I'm going to squeeze your hand twice throughout the scene multiple times. And this, before we even got into the dungeon, I had this conversation. I said, you need to squeeze my hand back twice. If you don't, I'm going to consider that to be a safe word to stop and check in with you.
Yeah.
And having this conversation outside of the context of the dungeon is trauma-informed, and it's great for, kind of ensuring that, but also in the context of neurodiversity, you can go nonverbal, you can have really intense, intimate, emotional moments, and having a physical safe word or shaking your head side to side, tapping out. I also like to hum happy birthday. That's a really good one. Different ways of accommodating and ensuring just a safer and more informed consensual experience all around. It doesn't have to be restrictive. It can actually be kind of fun to explore all this.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think to your point about the nonverbal safe word, you know, obviously we in sort of this field talk a lot about how verbal consent is equally as important to you know, bodily consent, because you can't read someone's body language. Obviously, if you have a negotiated stage scene and there are elements that are, you know, coming to play, you know, excluding all situations where you've like mapped out how the scene is going to go down, you know, body language, you just can't rely on it as a form of consent in its own right. And there have to be other elements. And, you know, for folks who are not in the kink or BDSM communities, it can be like a, you know, how's that? It doesn't have to be, do you still consent, you know? But my guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that especially for folks who are neurospicy or neurodiverse, masking can come into play when you're in sort of the performative nature that sex can be, and that having a nonverbal opportunity to say, hey, I need to check in, you know, can avoid any risk of masking kind of coming into play for an unspoken kind of withdrawal of consent.
Definitely. And the other thing to consider, a lot of the times, and we've been masking all day. Mm. I am emotionally drained. So I'm already going into this situation a little bit emotionally drained and vulnerable. And then when you get into a lot of times sexuality spaces, it is a vulnerable space. So there is a lot that I'm contending with kind of going into this scene. And nonverbal safe words absolutely are a really great way to get around that. But also, like, if your mouth is otherwise preoccupied, shaking your head side to side is a really great way to communicate.
Yeah.
And going nonverbal can even happen to people that are neurotypical.
Yeah, totally.
So it is a very good, I think, way around it. There's another one is if, I think a lot of times if you have like somebody's face that's going to be covered and you can't see anything, having something in your hand that you can drop is also a good safe action. But also to the note of just giving and receiving those consensual conversations that are sexy, you can even turn that into an opportunity for some affirmations. I mean, again, playing with a little bit of power and authority. Yeah. I'll ask my bottoms, tell me how good I look.
Yeah.
And then an open-ended question in that capacity also takes away from a trauma response. So if you ask a yes or no question, it's really easy for a fawning response to come out and somebody to just say yes.
Yeah.
It can go along with the neurospicy thing. But if you ask something that kind of makes them have to think about it a little bit, it's pretty hot. And it helps kind of break out of that, that I guess drive to mask and drive to have that response. But then on the other side of that, I can then describe to them how they look. And that's just a really intimate, incredible experience too. So there's ways to check in that are sexy still and also accessible and accommodating and just fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I try to drive home this concept, and people maybe are tired of it, but I think it's so important that you cannot bypass things like safety and accessibility just because, you know, they don't do it in porn, so people think it's not sexy, right? There's so many ways to maintain steamy vibes, sensuality, whatever that looks like, through just playing around with what all of this can look like for any dynamic, right?
Yeah, have fun with it. See just kind of what happens. It doesn't have to be this methodical. I mean, I say this as a spreadsheet girly, but it doesn't have to be so rigid. You can still have that exchange, and it's really hot. I mean, who doesn't want to be told that they look sexy? Like, obviously. So it's still a consent conversation. It's still accessible and just kind of hitting all those different notes, and it's still sexy.
Yeah. I have one more question really on this, I guess. And, you know, when you think through the way you engage with different partners, do you, find that sometimes you have to kind of meet them halfway in their own accessibility needs or their own needs in general? And if so, how do you balance accommodating other people while maintaining your own, your own needs, accessibility or otherwise?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because for me personally, as an educator, as a neurospicy educator, all that, I tend to almost go more into teacher mode and ensure that my students, quote unquote students in this context, are informed and everything. But I do find that at times I have to remind myself that this is my intimate experience just as much as it is theirs.
Yeah.
And I need to give them the opportunity to be able to be there for me, to be able to have the same intimate exchange with me. And if I focus too much on apologizing for my needs, on also assuming their needs, then I don't give them the opportunity to engage to that same level. And my job is really to try to balance any kind of power differential, to just explore and have a fun time with this person. So I think just reminding yourself that this is an equal exchange of power, of fun, of intimacy, authority, all of it is a great way to kind of ground yourself. And it may seem a little like one off, but that not tonight list that I started off with, it doesn't have to be a whole spreadsheet, is a good way of kind of revisiting intentionality too. So I know that's kind of, it seems almost like a bit of a woo answer, but like intentionality, reminding yourself of all these things and just grounding yourself in different ways that feel safe and authentic and fun for you can be a great way of doing that. And also accepting that their consent framework may not work with your accessibility needs. And as long as they're not a dick about it, then, they have that capacity and agency too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And you know, I think, I'm not like a very woo person, but I agree with this idea of intentionality. Like, I think things like intentionality and mindfulness are really important when practicing any kind of sexual encounter experience with yourself or others. I think it's how boundaries are formed and understood and how pleasure is discovered, and all of those things are really important. And you mentioned earlier being a recovering people pleaser. I think some of that ties into all of this too, and owning your needs and, everyone's right to their needs, but being respectful of other people's needs at the same time. It is a dance, but it's an important one that we're all trying to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be fun. It doesn't have to be restricted. These are opportunities for growth and intimacy. I mean, I think really the scene starts before you get flogged. Yeah. The scene starts before any of that. You are just exchanging energy, define energy how you will. And it can be sexy, fun, and interesting.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think anticipation is one of the, fun parts about any sexual encounter, in my opinion, right? Yes. So like, lean into it, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's scene foreplay, building that anticipation and playing with that power. It's so sexy. I'm here for all that.
I love it. Is there anything else that you wanted to share, or any other words of wisdom that you feel like it's important to kind of discuss or chat through?
I mean, I feel like my neurospicy brain is like, let me go on all the really side quests.
Open. I gave you a really open-ended question that probably wasn't very helpful for me.
No, no, I love it though. Oh, goodness. I think just as a neurospicy person, understand that you deserve and should experience intimacy however that looks for you. Mm. And it may not look like how everybody else experiences it. And that's just as fine and just as valid and just as sexy. So I would say that's probably the last little pearl of wisdom that I can think of.
Awesome. I love it. Thank you so much for your time this evening. I think this is a topic that not enough people in the sex content creation space are talking about. I think it's growing more, but I'm excited to be sharing your story and lived experience and some important information. I think this has been super interesting and educational. I know that you offer like workshops and classes. How can people get in touch with you if they're interested in working with you? What might that look like?
Yeah. This was so much fun, by the way. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. Yeah. So you can find me on my website, lilithfox.com. That's LilithFoxx. I'm also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Not very good about being on social media, despite being a marketing professional. So the Lilith Fox is where you can find me there. I mean, just shoot me an email, send me a message. I love connecting with the community. So yeah, I love it.
Awesome. And for folks who didn't take notes, which is totally fair, I have included those lovely links in the show notes below. So you can click, check out Lilith Fox and the website, the social, all of it. Thank you so much again for your time. This has been really fun. I've really enjoyed our conversation and I'm excited to share it with everyone else.
Me too. Thanks so much for having me. This was so fun.
All right, thanks everyone.